Welcome to Color Country Politics, where we discuss all the important political issues facing Iron County, Utah. Our guests include elected officials and community leaders in or representing Iron County.
This is episode 42, Chairman of the Board.
Welcome back to Color Country Politics. We are really excited to be here today. I'm Jenny Hendricks.
I'm Jesse Harris.
And we are thrilled to have gubernatorial candidate Thomas Wright with us here today. We were able to kind of snag him as he was coming through Southern Utah and give you guys kind of an insight into why he's running, what he's doing, why he's here, and what's important. So thank you so much.
Oh, it's so great to be here with you.
Yeah,
I think the world of both of you. And I think it's great what you're doing, giving people an opportunity to talk in more detail about why they're running and some of the issues that we face. I think it's a fantastic forum.
Yeah, we find that our audience really enjoys getting sort of those more in-depth answers. So, like I said, Thomas Wright is a gubernatorial candidate. His running mate is Rob Bishop, which I got to tell you was a brilliant move.
Thank you.
That was fabulous.
Thank you.
But let's just start telling us kind of your history, why you're here, why this is important. Yeah. Who are you?
Yes, who are you? Well, I'm a Utah native. I was born in Utah. I was raised in Utah. I'm a product of Utah public schools. My kids are products of public schools. And I love Utah. And I love everything about it. I built my business here. I've raised my family here. My wife and I have four children, been married 22 years. And we have built our life here, and we love Utah. Mm-hmm. And I'm not from government. I've been involved in the political process, being a volunteer in the Utah Republican Party, having been the chairman and delegate and some of those things that are volunteer positions. So I know the process. I know some of the challenges, and I know how it all works. Mm-hmm. But I don't have all that entanglement. I don't have all those past votes and relationships people I'm beholden to. But I'm really concerned about Utah. Yeah. We've been the best managed state. We've had some great leadership in this state. We all love living in Utah.
Right.
We love the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. We love the people.
Yeah.
Don't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's an incredible place.
Yeah.
But it's who we are to want to be better.
Yep.
And we know that when things are going really well, two things can happen. It can be really easy to do nothing mm-hmm. and just think it's going to always be that way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes leadership, you're like, wow, it's going really well. Maybe I'll just do nothing. That's a temptation that you can't fall for.
Right.
And two, we know that if we think it's our destiny to always be on top, mm-hmm. we'll lose it.
Mm-hmm.
When you get that pride going and you think, oh no, it's just Utah. We're going to always be this way. That's the time you have to really guard against some of the challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So I look down the road and I say to myself, I've never held a public office. I've been a volunteer. I know how it works, but I've been a business person.
Mm-hmm.
I built a business. I built a real estate business in the Great Recession.
Mm-hmm.
I know what it's like to make payroll and to grind away on those lease payments.
Right.
And,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
You guys remember
Great.
That?
Great. Great.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. How could we ever forget?
Right.
Please don't ever let me forget. Yeah. And I know what that's like. And I know what it's like to be loyal to employees and have people relying on you and their families relying on you, and to do it in arguably one of the most difficult real estate markets ever.
Yeah.
Made me tough.
Yeah.
Made me gritty.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I developed some leadership skills that I think could serve the state of Utah. Well, it's uncomfortable to talk about myself like this, but I really believe that we're at this point in Utah where if we don't tackle some of these issues that are right ahead of us,
mm-hmm.
and we believe that it'll always just be like this for us, that we may look back and say, wow, if we had started a little bit sooner,
mm-hmm.
maybe could have avoided some of those challenges that reared up.
Sure.
So my job as a CEO is to look around the corner
and
anticipate those problems.
Yeah.
That's what I want to do with state government.
Well, let's talk about that. What do you see coming around the corner? What are some of the issues that are important to you that you want to take on?
Yeah, first and foremost, and I love that you mentioned Congressman Bishop. I feel so lucky to have him on my team. And one of the things that I loved about Congressman Bishop as a running mate is he's been a public school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that our public education system, while we have some great things going on and there's incredible people and there's some districts doing some very innovative things, so I don't want to be critical of the whole system,
mm-hmm.
there is a lot of improvement that can be made. And I think everybody in the system knows that.
Yeah.
And so public education for me is probably the number one priority, because our human capital mm-hmm. is what attracts people to the state.
Mm-hmm.
You can have the best roads, you can have the best infrastructure, you can have all the best airport. I mean, you can do all these things really well. But if your workforce isn't ready and they're not available and they don't work hard and they don't have the right skills, then suddenly the businesses are looking at other alternatives and options.
Yeah.
And so
I want to dial in on that a little bit. I've got two kids at the University of Utah. hopefully my son is graduating this spring.
Me too. I love your mug, by the way.
This, you know what? This is one, I think this was my son that did this probably 15 years ago. So
yeah.
Anyway, they're away from home. I'm an empty nester, so I keep that.
You know, it kind of reminds me of a mug that one of my kids gave me. Maybe I'll tweet a picture to you.
Oh, that'd be
but
great.
It says on it, sometimes when the family's all together and we talk and I'll have an idea, and of course, you know, nobody listens to dad.
Right.
And when I'm right, I'll say, oh, you know, dumb old dad.
Right.
So I refer to myself jokingly in our family as dumb old dad.
I hear you.
One Father's Day, I opened it, and it was a mug from Color Me Mine. It's very similar in color to that, the orange.
Uh-huh.
That's why I'm commenting on your mug, and it said on it, dumb old dad.
I love that.
So it's like one of my most prized possessions.
I love
but my daughter felt a little bad about it, so the next year I opened the gift, and it was a mug, and it said, my superhero dad.
Oh,
so she wanted to make sure she knew. So,
yeah, so there's a lot
so I have complimentary
there.
Mugs.
I love that.
It's all about the mug, isn't it?
Yeah,
really?
I love that. Thank you
Our
for
families.
Pointing out
yeah.
that mug. No, family is, I think, one of the things that in Utah is, it's really the core of who we are culturally. And I think that that is a huge part of our success as a state is that focus on families, that willingness to pull together. But I don't want to leave the education topic. I really want to dial down on that because like I say, my kids are at the U and I've said this before, so this isn't a surprise. I feel like they were not quite prepared.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about, let's dial in on this and tell me about specifics on what your plan is for education,
yeah.
like
yeah.
from start to finish.
Well, thanks for asking. The first is we have a teacher shortage in this state.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, my wife was a public school teacher. She hasn't taught for a few years, but she has her master's degree in education, was a school teacher. So this is near and dear to
mm-hmm.
us.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But what we know is we have a teacher shortage in this mm-hmm. state. A few years ago, we had to waive the requirement for a teaching credential because we couldn't hire enough teachers. Now, I know in business, this is about supply and demand,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
When you don't have enough demand for a job, what's usually the reason? It's pay.
Yeah.
Pay. You're not paying enough.
Right.
We know teachers don't teach because they think they're going to get independently wealthy.
Right.
Yeah.
They teach because they love to teach.
Yeah.
And you meet with these teachers and they're the passion they have for teaching
right.
and their love of children,
mm-hmm.
it just blows me away.
Mm-hmm.
So they deserve to be paid the fair market wage that they can live on.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want teaching in this state to become a second income profession.
Right.
And there's many, like I said, there's districts that are doing this well
mm-hmm.
and they should be applauded,
mm-hmm.
but there is a challenge in many other districts with teacher pay. And if we want to fill those vacancies and support our children and get the best education, we have to start there. The educator is everything,
yeah.
right? Getting that money into the classroom is a huge priority. So we've got to pay them a better wage so we can fill those vacancies. And we'll have more competition.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine a scenario where more people want to teach than
yeah.
we have jobs?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's the supply
That's
and demand
pretty foreign
thing, right?
yeah.
compared to what we have right now.
Right. So that for me is a big thing because one, they deserve it. Two, it'll create a better outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got to prioritize the dollars to get into the classroom and make sure that the teacher's being paid.
How do you do that from the governor's office
yeah.
versus how, you know, your interaction with the state school or the local school
yeah.
boards and that kind of distribution?
Good question. The reason it's a good question is the governor really has no seat at the public education table,
mm-hmm.
right? The only thing the governor does with public education, and this isn't talked about enough,
mm-hmm.
is appoint the charter school board members.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing in statute that the governor does is that.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't really deal with public education. But I think it's a positive in my particular case that the governor isn't at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why. When you're not at the table, you're not a threat. What you can do is bring everyone together
mm-hmm.
and talk about what we all really want, and that's the mm-hmm. best outcome for our children.
Yeah.
We know the teachers want that. We know the districts want that. We know the legislature wants that. We all want that. And when you're kind of a neutral third party, but you're the governor, you have a platform,
you have
the microphone, and you can lead out.
Yeah.
You can step up and say, hey, I'm going to bring these floating islands
mm-hmm.
together. And together we're going to unify into a larger mass for the greater good and for the good of our children. And so I like that part of it. I think there's some positives to it, but let's be honest, there's differing points of view inside
yeah.
the legislature. I mean, this year I think we have about 200 bills related to public education going.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the school districts have different ideas.
Yeah.
And sometimes the teachers and the, you know, I mean, there's
right.
differing opinions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it does need some leadership to bring people together.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we've been doing things relatively well, and there's some bright spots, but it can
mm-hmm.
definitely be improved.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the commitments I've made is, as governor, I want to go to the state school board meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to be a participant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm happy to go as the governor around the state, go to these meetings, sit, listen to our 15 school board members, listen to what their goals and ideas are, the people that represent, that they represent, and then take those back to the Capitol, talk to legislators about the legislative agenda. How do we meld those together? Continue to meet with teachers and listen to them and really have a leadership role in bringing everyone together.
That's great.
Isn't it great when you have the opportunity to make a difference and you don't care who gets credit? I just want it to be better. And I don't have a seat at the table. So in the end, if it improves, I'll be the last person that will get credit. So it'll work out perfectly. Right?
That's great.
I think it was Reagan who said, you'd be amazed what you can accomplish and you don't care who gets the credit.
Oh, wasn't he great?
Oh, he was
great. And so, so that's number one is teacher pay. Another specific is the classroom's overregulated. And it's overregulated by the federal government, which is harder for us to correct because we take federal money and with it comes their strings.
Absolutely.
I don't want to be overly optimistic about what we can do about that. But that's another reason I love Congressman Bishop as my running mate. He understands Washington, D.C. He's been a school teacher. If there's anyone that could go to Washington, D.C. and help get some waivers on some of this regulation and allow us to do things the Utah way, it would be Congressman Bishop. And then we can look at the state and say, hey, what are we doing in the state to make it more difficult to teach? And it's not, it's never intentional. So sometimes we pass legislation or we do things that, man, it add more paperwork, add more
unintended consequences.
And just sit down and say, hey, again, bring those islands together and say, hey, what can we do better? Teachers to support you. Hey, districts, what's holding you back? What's keeping the money from flowing more into the classroom? So we can all kind of get together and say, this isn't about blame and credit. This is about improvement. And we can all improve.
Absolutely.
So deregulating the classroom is big.
Great. I love that word.
Those are the two top things that teachers cite when they leave the profession is, I wasn't being paid enough and I had to do too much paperwork.
And isn't it amazing when they get into teaching not for the money, and then we do two things to them. We pay them too little to live on in some instances, and we overregulate them. And the only thing you're guaranteed when you do that to an employee is they eventually will quit. Because we have, what, the lowest unemployment we've ever had, which is really underemployment. There's not enough people for the jobs. And so naturally, what do? They look around at what are the other options.
With this skill set, with this education, where can I take this? And
hey, if I can go from making X to Y, and Y is 30% more, and I don't have to deal with all the bureaucracy and the drama, and I can just work this job, and it becomes pretty enticing. And so we've got to make it more enjoyable again, and we got to pay better so we can get back in competition with the alternatives that teachers have.
I love that market-based solution because our teachers are in competition with other professions because it is fluid, they can leave. So
that's what we love about our capitalist society.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that goods and services and people will flow to where they're valued the most.
Absolutely.
That's the essence of who we are. And that's why I love bringing the business perspective because I know government's not a business. And I know the governor's not the CEO that just gets to make all the decisions. I get it. But leadership and bringing some of those principles in and just breaking them down in simple macroeconomic terms, I think people really understand. I think it resonates with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the third thing with public education is I was just with a school teacher who had a student that, you know, bites and hits and turns desk over. And your heart goes out to that young man. And you want him to succeed. And I'm sure we'll figure out how to make that happen. But the teacher can't be the teacher of 30 and be the behavioral health expert and dealing with all this. So not just deregulating the classroom, but further supporting the classroom in new and innovative ways based on some of the new mental health challenges we have in the state. And it's hard to talk about, but we have one of the highest teen suicide rates in the country. And public education is right there in those formative years. So we've got to figure out.
Right on the first line, you know. So
and we can't ask. Teachers will do it. This teacher said, I will do it. I love that kid. And I'll make it work. And I'll still figure out how to teach. But maybe there's a way to support that student better while simultaneously making it easier for the 29 other kids. And maybe there's some other challenges in there I don't know of, but then also for the teacher, making it more rewarding and easier to do the job. So the world's changed a little bit. We ought to change. And then just finally on public education, we've learned so much in the last 10 or 20 years about how the mind learns and how kids' brains function. And we've got to modernize our system to allow us to capitalize on that new knowledge. We are teaching in the same classrooms and the same style we did maybe 50 years ago. And so we can improve that by saying, hey, we know a third of the kids respond to that style. But then there's two thirds that maybe are learning in new and different ways. How do we kind of approach this in a new, innovative way? And can we improve it so we're reaching the children quicker and inspiring them more?
Yeah.
And man, that will pay huge dividends for them.
Absolutely.
For their future families and for our great society.
Yeah.
It's a great state we live in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's great.
Those kids are curious and they want to learn stuff.
Don't they? Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're curious and they just want to be inspired. Mm-hmm. And not all kids are the same.
Absolutely.
And to think one size fits all is old thinking.
Yeah.
And there's a new and innovative way to do it. And that one is a lot harder to do than the other three I talked about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there are some places that are doing it really well. Mm-hmm. And school choice is a big part of that.
Yes.
It's a big part of that.
Yeah.
Parents know where their kids want to go and what they want to do. And
there's
some great options out there for arts and science and math. And if a kid's really gifted in one of those areas and really loves it, and they want to go down that road, we should allow the parents the choice and the freedom to be able to take their children where they're going to thrive.
That
includes homeschooling.
Yeah.
And all the other options. So there's many options that you can custom tailor to the student's needs so that everybody succeeds.
That's great.
My two school-age children are going to the local charter school. They're both on IEPs. They have autism. And that Montessori approach is great for them. And I know the district schools, they struggle to deal with, you know, kids who operate a little differently. And just having that option available makes all the difference. It's better for everyone who stays in the district school. It's better for my kids. It's better all around.
Right. And let's be really clear, because I know the three of us agree on this. District schools are great.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see somebody in that district school hearing this and saying, oh, they don't understand. Okay. And we maybe don't understand what they know. Mm-hmm. But we're not saying that they have been deficient.
Correct.
It's just they've been the place where everybody went. And what we're saying is sometimes there's people that are better off in another option. Let's give them that option.
Yeah.
And the public schools are still going to play an intricate role.
Oh, sure.
And are so vital. And they're doing a great job. They're doing the best they can with a lot of challenges.
Sure.
And I just want to help make it better. And I want to compliment everybody out there that's in that
Absolutely.
System. It's tough.
Well, and I do think that you've got such a great resource in Utah because you do have so many parent volunteers. You've got parents already in the classroom. What a tremendous resource that has been historically and continue to be.
Yeah. So. And I was thinking the other day, and I've never even said this publicly, so the team may not love this, but I was thinking the other day, you know, somebody said, well, teachers don't teach year round. You know, they only teach, you know, this many months. You've heard that before.
Yeah.
And I started thinking, well, you know, I got to look into that, make sure that's true. But also, we have these great tech companies in Utah. We have some great homegrown companies.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a great economy. It's very diverse in Utah. Mm-hmm. What if teachers wanted to do a quick internship in one of these? What if a math teacher in high school really wanted to go see the way, you know, Qualtrics does quantitative analysis and the way kids are actually using calculus in the Silicon Slope.
Once they've graduated and are applying.
Yeah, and if you went to them and said, hey, do you want to do some internships and have some teachers come through so you can see, they can see firsthand the workforce needs.
I love that.
Then the teachers would be inspired, and that's what they really want, and that's why they're teaching, as we discussed earlier.
Absolutely.
So I just think there's a way better public-private partnership with education. I think there's a lot of uncharted territory that'd be really fun to explore with all the people that are in the system.
With all the stakeholders, that's great.
Yeah.
Team's got to be okay with that, right?
Yeah.
Oh, we don't care. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that insight. That was great information. So you had mentioned you have sort of multiple parts to what your platform is and why you're running. Tell us what's next after education.
Well, I think the issue is related to growth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've experienced tremendous growth in the states, population-wise, economically. So with that comes a lot of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Air quality along the Wasatch Front and in Cache Valley and in other places. Transportation, infrastructure, we all see the gridlock, and it's pretty prevalent around the state, even in St. George and areas of southern Utah, like Cedar City, starting to see more and more congestion, which diminishes our quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And then just the other things of affordable housing is a big problem that we have to address in the state.
Mm-hmm.
The thing with affordable housing is it's not just about finding people affordable housing so they can live. It's the byproducts of not having affordable housing, like children not reaching their potential, like increased in behavioral health problems.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be tied to this, you know, these challenges we have with suicide and some of these other things. So we've got to take this affordable housing crisis really seriously. We're 55,000 units short.
Right.
And we can't be heavy-handed from the state telling municipalities what to do.
You'll get a lot of pushback.
Without that, that is not the Utah way. We say we don't want the federal government in our business.
Uh-huh.
Well, the counties and state and cities don't want the state in their business.
Right.
Yeah.
But the state can lead and inspire.
Yeah.
and
provide
and
some kind of a framework, provide ideas. I know mm-hmm. that there's some legislation going through right now to try and tie maybe some transportation money to some affordable housing. So there are things that can happen at the state level that can guide or inspire more at the local, municipal, and county level.
Right. And let's be smart. Let's work together. Mm-hmm. But I loved, like, and I've cited this before, but Jake Andrick's bill last year, Senate Bill 34, was a list of 25 things municipalities mm-hmm. can do. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a requirement. It was just, mm-hmm. hey, here's a roadmap. Can you just tell us which three or four of these are working for you?
Yeah.
And I talked to a mayor in Davis County that said, you know, we read that at first and we're like, I don't know if this is going to work. But then he said, we actually were inspired by some of the ideas on the list that we hadn't thought of before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we need to do. Because, like, Utahns are, we're compassionate, we're hardworking, we care about everyone in our society, and we'll do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
We just need to be inspired to do it sometimes, mm-hmm. and sometimes we just need a little direction, and we need to know the problem that's out there.
Right.
Because it can be easy to get into your regular life working, you're busy, and you just don't realize there's an affordable housing crisis maybe.
Right. Yeah.
But to a lot of people out there, they realize it,
yeah.
and it's dramatically affecting their quality of life.
Yeah, so, no, the cost of housing has risen so high relative to the income over the last, you know, maybe 10 or 12 years, that disparity is kind of getting away from us just a little bit.
You're absolutely right. The costs of the housing have gone up dramatically faster than the wages, even though wages have grown. It's pretty dramatic. And you know, I think the other thing is for those of us that have kids that are growing up and getting to that age where they'll become buyers, how sad would it be to have them not in Utah because they couldn't afford it?
Right.
And we obviously, some of us more than others, don't want our kids living in our basement. and so what we have to be careful of is that we don't make it so unaffordable that that's happening, because that's not good for anyone. Like I said, for kids and behavioral health, all the things that we talk about.
Yeah.
But also, we want people to live their own lives, and we want them to live that American dream. And we know home ownership is at the heart.
Sure.
Of that American dream.
Absolutely.
and or being in your own home is
Absolutely.
At the heart, and we've got to make that possible. And there are things the state can do along those lines while not being heavy-handed.
And I mean, it's and being in real estate, this is a conversation that we have a lot, is, you know, home ownership isn't just for the homeowners, and it builds more stable communities.
Mm-hmm.
It helps build wealth with those families and in the community. One of the things, and I'm kind of throwing this at just sideways here, we didn't talk about this before, but one of the things that I thought about is, we don't necessarily want to make housing attainable. We want to make housing affordable, but we don't necessarily want to take value away from anyone's
mm-hmm.
home.
Right.
I mean, one of the things we're seeing mm-hmm. now is people reaping such great benefit from the equity
mm-hmm.
that has, you know, is sort of a side effect of the market going up. So I hope that there's an intersection between housing affordability and wage growth where we're not creating a deficit for either side. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Because, and this kind of is hard to talk about, but there's a lot of people in a lot of communities that think, okay, we need affordable housing, but we don't necessarily want it in our backyard.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
And so it's that NIMBY, so to speak, mentality.
Yeah.
And I think that too gets to just taking the stigma away from what affordable housing is.
Yeah.
It's not the negative thing that people think it is. It could be higher density,
mm-hmm.
so there could be more people, but if it's coupled with mass transit and makes it easier for people to move around,
mm-hmm.
that can be really good.
Mm-hmm.
Can also tie affordable housing to air quality. Because,
mm-hmm.
and I said this in the Silicon Slopes debate, but when you allow people, well, the most affordable land
mm-hmm.
is on the perimeter of any metropolitan
right.
area. So what happens is, the developer buys the land, well, now that's their cost basis, so naturally the home price will be less.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is, okay, well, now people are commuting further.
Right.
So now you have more air quality issues. Now you got to build more roads
because
mm-hmm. they're further out.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, now you're building new schools.
Mm-hmm.
That's taken away from our public education budget,
mm-hmm.
or there could be schools in urban areas that are less populated than they once were, which is the case in some of our urban areas.
That's happening.
Yeah.
And so now you're building another school. Now you have a further, teacher shortage problem.
Right.
Now you're competing for more. So it's just amazing to me, as I've been running, how intertwined all these issues are.
Yeah.
You think they're in silos.
Yeah.
And we'll just kind of take on one or the other and we'll deal with them. But they are all really
Absolutely.
Interconnected.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing is, and I look at these big box retailers as a solution, and you see these parking lots that are massive.
Yeah.
And in the Amazon world,
uh-huh.
we're shopping at those retail places less, and it kills me for those retailers.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand their plight, but there's big open areas where we could put some affordable housing and have mass transit right there, and people could be walking to the gym instead of driving. And and we know with air quality that it comes from those cold starts.
Right, right.
So if you can cut down on those cold starts, you're going to have less emissions and you get people walking more. So all these issues are just like all woven. It's like a bowl of spaghetti.
Right.
You can't just grab one and pull it out, right? You're going to have a big mess on your hands if you try to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, well made point. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so anything else on growth before we move on?
Oh, there's so much, but I think we've covered a lot of it, but transportation's huge, and you know, we need to utilize rail more to transport our goods and get see if we can get some of the trucks off the road. The only solution can't be, or the main solution, just widening and expanding roads.
Right.
We do need to do that in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. There's a proper role for that, but mass transit and using rail has got to be we've got to have a cultural shift, and that's going to take some time. And one of the things I liken it to is seatbelts. You know, when I was a kid, I remember my mom stopping on a road to pull one of my brothers off the top of the station wagon.
Right.
Literally. And, you know, when we were all just climbing around in there, it was kind of a free-for-all. And now we wear our seatbelts.
Uh-huh.
We don't do that.
Uh-huh.
And that was a hard cultural shift.
Right, yeah.
And we can do that with transportation.
Uh-huh.
Instead of this, hey, everybody's driving in their own car. And the philosophy on mass transit is, let's build it so people will get off my roads.
Yeah.
I want that straight shot to work on the road. Everybody else take it. I want my road back. Gotta change that.
I saw a thing the other day that said, if you're sitting in traffic complaining about traffic, remember that you are the traffic.
Yeah. And so, we can all do better, right? Me, maybe you. I mean, we can all do better in that. Trip chaining, living closer to where we work, walking more.
Mm-hmm.
I went to church the other day and I counted about 100 cars that had driven maybe three blocks or less, right? Yeah. And I was one of them.
Well, it was probably really cold. In your defense.
Yeah, and you know what? There are people that need to drive to church. I understand. There's a lot of people that do. But I was thinking to myself, I could get up 10 minutes earlier. I could walk.
Uh-huh.
I don't need to be driving here.
Yeah.
And there's what? If 70 of those cars don't drive, that's 140 less starts.
Yeah.
One to go, one to come home.
Right.
We just have to start thinking about it differently. And I think if we have leadership talking about these really small, finer points like cold starts and walking, and I think it becomes more cultural.
No, I agree. I think that it is it's a cultural thing. And I remember sitting in the back of the station wagon facing where you just came from. You know,
did you see my brother on
the roof? Yeah, but you're right. It is a cultural shift. Nobody wore seat belts when I was a kid. We rode in the back of the truck and nobody cared. You know?
Yeah. No, it's just a different. So we can do it.
Yeah. No, I think
that's an inspiring. Seatbelts is an inspiration point for me.
Yeah.
Because I remember thinking, oh, how are they going to get everybody to work? Do you remember thinking that?
Yeah.
And we did.
Yeah.
We did it.
And we did.
So we can do it. We can do it with our transportation thing.
Yeah. Okay. Go team.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Yeah. I talked about this at a town hall, and I even said, you know, let's put, you know, the inversion is there in the Salt Lake Valley, which is where we deal with air quality, or even along the Wasatch Front or Cache Valley. And the storm comes in and blows it out.
Uh-huh.
And then everybody fires up their snowblower,
right?
And you hear them, you see that coming out, and those are not like tier three efficient engines and fuel.
Right.
And you think, wow, we just blew it out, and here we're gonna do it all over again. And I said, maybe we could shovel a little more, or you know, maybe the leaf blower can be left, and we can give each other a high five for having grass clippings on our sidewalk. Maybe that could become a badge of honor.
There you go.
Right?
There you go.
Do we care?
I can see a campaign about grass clippings forming out.
But then it snowed the next day, and one of the guys at the town hall texted me a picture of him shoveling, and he said, I put the snowblower away, and I thought, hey, there's change.
Wow.
Right?
Look at you making things happen right now.
I just think we all talk about it, right? Then our kids will just grow up thinking that's the way it is.
Right.
Yeah.
I love it.
We can be the change we want to see.
Great point.
Yeah.
Okay, fabulous.
Okay.
All right, anything else on growth? You want to move on?
No, we can move on. Yeah, there's a lot on growth.
I know.
We covered a lot.
We could actually do that.
We gave our snowblowers and leaf blowers away, and we're walking to church.
Shoveling.
We covered a lot of ground.
I like it. We're push mowers.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, tell me your thoughts on the rural Utah issues, because what I see is, if you're not in a population center, which we are not, sometimes our issues are not prioritized. And I get it. You've got to go where the population centers are. But what are your thoughts on what we're dealing with in the rural parts of the state?
I love this question, because this is another reason that I wanted Congressman Bishop on my team. He's somebody that understands rural Utah. He fights for rural Utah. And the best part is he wins. He does. He wins. He understands rural Utah, and he understands the public land component that goes along with that in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that you don't have to be from rural Utah to care deeply about rural Utah. And as the next governor, I will prove that. I'm not from rural Utah, but I care deeply about it. And there needs to be equity. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about what that means, because there isn't right now. Mm-hmm. And if I'm just being honest, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. It's been really surprising to me how much I've learned about areas of the state that are still in a recession, mm-hmm. or never came out of a recession. Yeah. And the Wasatch Front's been booming, mm-hmm. and we've been bragging about growth, mm-hmm. and success. Mm-hmm. And to think all these counties and these areas, and most of these areas in rural Utah, are really struggling, mm-hmm. hits hard. Mm-hmm. And I really believe if a governor was talking about that regularly, the rest of the Utahns that are not in those rural areas would care a lot, mm-hmm. and they would want to see change. Mm-hmm. Because the way I see it is, these rural communities are very tight-knit.
Yep.
Everyone knows each other. I mean, there's nothing more fun than going to lunch in rural Utah. Everybody's talking to each other. I would say, man, I want to live here.
Right.
It's amazing. They care so much about each other.
Yeah.
It's such an incredible feel.
It really is. Yeah.
And so they love living there. Mm-hmm. And what we have to admit as a state is, they don't want to leave and come to the Wasatch Front.
No.
And the Wasatch Front really can't handle them now.
No, you can.
Anyway.
If all of us picked up and moved to the Wasatch Front, you don't have anywhere to put us.
Yeah, and we don't want that. And we don't want that because our rural communities are a part of the fabric, mm-hmm. of our past, our mm-hmm. present, and are such an important part of the future, mm-hmm. going forward. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so how do you maintain those communities? Mm-hmm. And I think there's some things you can do. Mm-hmm. There are companies that I believe we can get to hire people in a remote situation, mm-hmm. in those rural communities, mm-hmm. that would cut down on congestion, driving,
all
the traffic,
just
and it would provide more jobs, mm-hmm. economic base in those local communities. Mm-hmm. But that's not going to be enough. Mm-hmm. The economic incentives that we've seen along the Wasatch Front don't need to continue, mm-hmm. in most cases. Mm-hmm. I don't want to close the door on those totally,
right?
Because there could be high-paying, high-skilled jobs we want,
yeah.
and they can only function in that area. So I'm not going to slam the door.
Sure.
But by and large, the economic incentives we've seen need to come to a stop. Mm-hmm. And we need to put that money, or some money, into more economic development in rural Utah. We have incredible people. Mm-hmm. They love where they live. Mm-hmm. They don't want to leave. Mm-hmm. They don't want their kids to leave. Mm-hmm. Their kids don't want to leave.
Yeah.
And we need to make sure that they continue to grow. Mm-hmm. So I love the idea of continuing our fiber and connectivity in those areas, because that's going to be a big part,
yep.
of their ability to connect with the,
yep.
world.
Yeah.
And do these remote jobs. But we also need to focus on diversifying those economies, because, mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, they're dependent on tourism, mm-hmm. or other industries that are seasonal, mm-hmm. or that maybe aren't as recession proof as others. Mm-hmm. And if we can diversify those economies, then people will get a better diversification, mm-hmm. and that will provide more sustainability,
yeah.
short and long term. Mm-hmm. And so then the question is, okay, great idea. That sounds great. What do we do? Well, what we do is we reach out to companies and we recruit companies that mix, that match the values of that community. Mm-hmm. Some of these communities don't want to be big. Mm-hmm. They don't want that tremendous growth, mm-hmm. and they need to decide what they want. The,
yeah.
state doesn't need to tell, you know, a city like Kanab what they want for economic development. They should decide what they want, mm-hmm. but the state should be a partner in helping make that happen, mm-hmm. so that community becomes less reliant on tourism and while still servicing the great tourism industry,
yeah.
they have, but diversifying the economy so the kids can stay.
Sure.
Another big thing, I think, is with higher education. Mm-hmm. We can do a lot of the higher education curriculum via the internet. Mm-hmm. And if we have that connectivity we talked about, we're not just, mm-hmm. creating remote workforce, but we're also allowing people to engage in higher education. And even more importantly, children in high schools could be involved in concurrent enrollment, mm-hmm. with those higher education institutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the thought that everybody needs to go get a 4-year degree is
right.
is not the way we need to go.
Yeah.
There's plenty of 2-year degrees, carpentry, mechanics. Mm-hmm. And we need to take the stigma to the degree there is any for those,
yeah.
and take that off and create those kinds of jobs in our local community. Because what happens is, right now, because they can't complete higher education in those rural communities, what do? They leave.
Mm-hmm.
And where do they go? Like, let's take Kanab, for example. Where do they go? They go to SUU in, mm-hmm. Cedar City, or they go to St. George, to Dixie State, or maybe they go up to Salt Lake, go to Salt Lake Community College. And usually what happens when they do that is they go up and they get integrated into society and they get a degree, and then what happens?
They don't come back.
They don't come back.
Yeah.
There's no job sitting here for them.
Yeah.
I know so many people that went to SUU, got their degree, and looked around and said, man, I don't want to leave, but there's no job for my degree.
Yeah. Right. And so that's why keeping them in the community while they're getting that education will inspire them to find those workforce opportunities that exist in rural Utah. But I can tell you right now that Governor Wright, if elected, will focus on rural Utah. I won't be able to forget about it because I have Congressman Bishop. and he, like I said, he fights for rural Utah and wins.
Yeah.
But more than that, it's a priority to me.
Good.
And it isn't just because it's a great talking point in a campaign. It's because it is so important to keep balance in the state.
Yeah.
We are already the fourth most urban state. If you look at our population, we are the fourth most urban state. I tell people that, they don't believe it.
Yeah.
I had a guy at a town hall Google it. And he was like, oh my gosh, you're right. And I was like, good. But we want to be who we are. Wasatch Front's an important part of who we are.
Sure.
A lot of good going on there, but we got to keep rural Utah in the picture, and it will not happen if we don't focus on it.
Correct. And we have such tremendous resources and assets here. I love that you brought up trades, because I want to close the loop on this, mm-hmm. because if you go back to our conversation about housing affordability and attainability, one of the huge factors is there's a lack of labor.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lack of skilled tradespeople to fill those jobs, and so homes aren't being built fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a focus and that kind of cultural shift that we've been talking about to get more people into the trades, those are very well-paying jobs. You can make as much money with a job in the trade or more than you can with many four-year degrees or higher.
Yeah.
So here in Cedar City, in Iron County, we've got SUU that you brought up. We've got Southwest Tech.
Sorry.
That does focus on those trades.
And they've done a great job integrating.
Jobs, and they have really let out.
I've been on the State Board of Regents for a few years, and I was on the Dixie State Board of Trustees before that. And what you've done with SUU and the technical clubs and merging those together is really ahead of the curve. And the rest of the state is really watching that.
Good.
And let me applaud Cedar City, too. You all have done a fantastic job of diversifying your economy,
mm-hmm.
right? You do have a big tourism component,
yep.
mm-hmm.
but you've also done a great job of attracting manufacturing jobs
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. In aerospace and another place, right? And you've done a great job of that. And I loved reading up on the Port 15 project,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Having that rail line that bisects, or I guess dissects that area and bringing goods in on rail and servicing Southern California and Las Vegas, getting those trucks off the road, using our rail lines, which is a lot less emissions and it's more efficient, and building that hub there that you can have commerce.
Yeah.
So Iron County, Cedar City,
we're just waiting.
Bravo. And I'm sure, I know you have challenges in other areas as well, but you've done a great job of doing exactly what I just talked about.
And I think that we are well positioned. So whoever is the next governor, if it's you, I'm telling you right now, we are very well positioned to help out with the Inland Port, with the tourism, with the trades jobs that we're talking about. We are ready to go.
Well,
we got your back.
I'm going to take you up on it.
Okay.
If I'm lucky enough to be Utah's next governor, I will. Cedar City is an important part of the state, and you have so much talent here.
Yeah.
You guys have such great perspective,
and
you're doing it. So why not take that expertise? And
I
really believe the next governor should really look at this as, we have great ideas as candidates. Mm-hmm. I think I have some ideas. But really, the strength of the state is in its people
mm-hmm.
and rallying people together that are diverse
mm-hmm.
and saying, let's come up with solutions that work for everyone to the degree we can and drawing on the wealth of knowledge that our citizens have.
Oh, it's huge.
It's incredible,
isn't
it?
It is amazing.
It is incredible. It's been the funnest part of the campaign.
Yeah.
Meeting people, and they know so much about their local communities. They care so much.
Yeah.
So no one person needs to feel like they got to take this on.
Sure.
They just got to be good at building consensus and reaching out and being humble enough to not care who gets the the credit, according to your Reagan quote.
Yeah.
Right?
That's great. Well, I appreciate that a lot. What else do we need to know about Thomas Wright, your campaign, the direction you're going? What do you want us to know?
Well, I'm kind of the startup company in this race, right? Like, I'm running against legacy companies that have higher name ID, that maybe are better financed or have more money, and they're all great people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, voters have a great choice.
Mm-hmm.
But I really believe that it's time for a new direction, mm-hmm. and a fresh face with a new perspective will serve Utah well.
Mm-hmm.
And we can look at problems in a new way. We can turn over some of the thinking in our government agencies to make things more efficient and just move Utah in a new direction while not leaving behind any of the great things that are going on. I love Utah. It's been consistently ranked the best managed state, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't reach for new heights and that there isn't a new level of thinking.
Absolutely.
And we shouldn't be complacent in our thinking, think it'll always be this way, because as we said earlier, that's the danger zone in life, right?
Absolutely.
And so I believe that there's a next level. I think I'm the right person to do it because I combine that political volunteerism and knowing how the system works, but I'm also not from government. I'm a business person. I want to bring that business thinking. So I want everyone to get to know me. Because I really feel like if they do, they'll like what they see.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be transparent with everyone. And I want everyone to know I'll always work hard, I'll always be transparent, and I'll bring it every day. I'm a tireless worker. I have a lot of energy. And there will not be one wasted day in a right Bishop administration.
I believe that. I absolutely believe that. I've seen it in action when you were chair of the GOP. I was on the State Central Committee.
Yeah.
And so I have seen that that effusive personality and that hard work ethic and your willingness to bring people together and look for solutions. I really admired that when we were working together.
Well, that's a high compliment. So. And you did great on the Central Committee. And that's really another thing that I think a Republican nominee for governor really needs to focus on is let's unify our party again.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since we've had that unity.
Yeah.
And I'm not afraid to talk about it. There's a lot of great people on both sides. I don't, I'm not in either side.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get some strong leadership to unify people and get our party back where it needs to be.
Okay.
That's a big priority.
I think that would be great. I think that would be extremely helpful for all the other goals if we're all rowing in the same direction.
Yeah.
So
Utah's a great place because we've had great conservative values.
Absolutely.
We need to keep it that way. And a lot of people are coming from blue states, and they bring some blue state thinking. So we've got to have a good conversation with them and love them and thank them for being here. But we know why Utah was, you know, consistently the best managed state, and that's because of our conservative values.
Yeah, fantastic. All right. Well, Thomas, thank you so much.
Thanks for having
me on.
Can I come on again? It's fun to be here.
Anytime.
Anytime.
We got a camera and a microphone.
Right.
We'll set it up anytime you want to come through.
Thank you so much for having
me on. Yeah, you bet. So this has been Color Country Politics. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Color Country Politics, a production in cooperation with Utah Politico Hub and graciously sponsored by Century 21 Prestige Realty at 121 North Main Street, Cedar City. Special thanks to Amoeba Crew for use of their song Background Indie Rock, licensed under Creative Commons. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever fine podcasts are found. Also, check out our YouTube channel where we post video of our interviews. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and our website at www.colorcountrypolitics.com.